This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. As usual, I'm going to ask that you please go rate and review the podcast in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get this podcast. It helps other people discover this podcast. Since the previous podcast, I mentioned Rhett and Link's deconversion. I've read a number of apologists respond to their deconversion stories and completely miss the point. I kind of think of this podcast as a bit of a remedy to that. We hear the honest stories of people who have had a life-altering faith and then subsequently come to the decision that they could no longer sustain that belief. The apologist misses the point by looking to blame the deconverted, rather than looking at the flaws of the claims of religions themselves. They often blame the former believer for not understanding apologetics. They blame them for having the wrong theology. They blame them for having the wrong eschatology. They blame them for wanting to sin. They blame them for wanting to love everyone. They blame them for a thousand things that all miss the point. The point is that when you start to even use a modicum of scrutiny on your own faith, even just a little bit of the scrutiny that you apply to someone else's faith, your own faith may succumb to that scrutiny. And that is the case with Link and Rhett, and that was the case for my guest this week. My guest this week is Stephen Barry. Stephen was studying theology at a Seventh-day Adventist college when he could no longer believe and deconverted. Stephen is a musician and loves music. He shares his wisdom about music in his blog, barryorchestra.tumblr.com. We discuss how explicitly spiritual music is interpreted as a deconvert. And we talk about the difficulties of leaving Christianity, and specifically the Black Church, which has such a sense of community beyond just the spirituality. Stephen has found a tremendous amount of community in the secular community post-deconversion, and so he has a very hopeful story. Here is my conversation with Stephen Barry. Stephen, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's good to finally have a conversation. I've been going through all the episodes, so I'm about halfway, I think, through the podcast right now. But I'm really enjoying it. It's interesting conversations all around. I like it.
Well, that's awesome. You and I connected, I think, on Facebook. You were telling me briefly about your story. What I'd like to hear is just first the 5-minute version. What was your religious background and where are you at these days?
Yeah, my religious background begins and ends in the Adventist Church. I was born and raised in that denomination, and that's all I knew. I didn't really know anything about other denominations. I think at about like 7 or 8, I thought that Christians were Seventh-day Adventists, and all the other people were just atheists, evil people, you know, like they hate God and all of that. So that was my mindset as like a 7 or 8 year old kid. So yeah, I went to theology school, you know, an Adventist college. I sang in the choir. I was part of Pathfinders. Pathfinders is kind of like an Adventist version of boy girl scouts or whatever. Okay, but they just make it all Christian-y, you know, like you're finding the path that God wants you to be on. And
right,
yeah, it's deep. It was fun though. We went on like a lot of camping trips and stuff like that. Like I always loved doing that, even though it did have a lot of Christian, you know, Bible study, you know, altar call stuff at the end or whatever. But I enjoyed being outdoors and just having fun with other people my age.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much my background. I was in it for about I don't know, 23, 24 years.
Okay.
You know, I'm only 30 years old, so most of my life.
A good portion of your life. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you have a degree in theology, or you studied theology.
I studied it for 2 years and I deconverted while I was studying it. So
interesting. Okay.
Now I have no degree and lots of untransferable credits just floating around out there. I did finally pay off my student loans though, so I feel happy about that.
Okay.
It's mostly a waste.
I feel you. Yeah, I have a church leadership degree, which means absolutely nothing to anyone.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like a bachelor's?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's in church leadership. Yeah.
So. Yeah.
So did you wind up using that though? Were you maybe a lay leader, or I don't know what the right terminology is for Seventh-day Adventists, but did you participate in leading the church in some way?
No, I didn't. I was involved in a lot of things, but by the time I got into school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I didn't even really want to be going for theology, but it was kind of an idea from my mom. And while I was in it, like the idea of being a pastor was kind of like this lofty thing, especially for me because I'm an introvert. So I couldn't imagine getting in front of people and speaking on a regular basis and having to interact with them and know everybody. And,
right,
you know, there's just so much that comes with it. And I thought, well, maybe if God really wants me to do it, he'll like change my personality or like make me able to deal with this sort of thing. But it just never happened. And so I would just change my major every semester. Like I'd be religious education or pastoral care, or it was some type of religion major, because I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just wanted to go to school and be around people my age. And, you know, it was kind of like a way to get away from a lot of stuff that I was dealing with at home. So I took it and, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. So before we get to the doubts, and I don't want to push you here at all, but what would you be willing to talk about what it was you were writing at home?
Yeah, I was very isolated, and my mom really had a lot of stake in me being a strong believer, strong Christian, and she wanted me to understand what it meant to be a real Christian, not just someone who went to church and went through the motions. And, you know, that manifested itself in a lot of different ways. But I was homeschooled a lot. I was homeschooled all through high school. I was in South Carolina. I was in a really small town in South Carolina. So it was just like, I felt like I was by myself most of the time.
Right.
You know, my sister went to college before me, and when I went there and I saw like all these young people just playing, you know, frisbee golf or whatever, and there's just like so many things to do, and I was just like, yeah, I want to go there. And then it's like, yeah, and then I'll like won't be living with my mom on my own, I'll make friends. And I didn't really so much care about, you know, I didn't have like a 5-year plan or anything like that, away from that bubble that I was in. In a way, that's kind of what happened. It was just a very expensive way to get out of it. Yeah.
So, yeah, let's get into that then. So you're, you know, at a religious college, and is that when you first started to have some doubts, or what was it that started to prompt you to ask questions?
I'd had some doubts before that, like when I was a teenager. It just felt, I don't know what it was. There was one time that I was praying and it felt like, you know, nothing happens. Like things kind of keep going on the way that they're going. But whenever I have thoughts like that, it would just be like another voice in my head that just be like, oh, you know, you're not supposed to think that. If you did that, then, you know, that means the devil's got control of your mind and he's going to take out your soul or whatever. So, you know, then I pray for forgiveness for even just having that thought and try to keep believing, I guess.
So right before we had some technical difficulties there, you said something really interesting, that you kind of performed the experiment of praying to the devil to see what would happen. And so I'd like you to repeat what you were saying.
Oh, yeah. I think I was like 14 years old, and I don't know. I guess just the experience of prayer was always kind of weird for me. There were some times where I really felt like something was happening, but most of the time it just felt like it's this thing that we do, but nothing really happens. And so one day I just decided, I wonder what will happen if I pray to the devil. So I did that. And I mean, of course, nothing happened, but.
It's really interesting though, because you were thinking to yourself, what would happen? And you literally did the experiment. So that's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I had forgotten about it for a long time, and then it just kind of popped up in my head. I was like, oh yeah, I actually did that, when I was a teenager, you know?
Yeah. You kind of intuitively recognized that prayer wasn't quite working the way it's supposed to, or the results weren't coming from what you expected.
Mm-hmm.
But was that the beginning of the doubts for you, or what were the core doubts that started to happen for you?
It was probably like an extension of that, but also when I got to college, I was surrounded by a lot of different people and a lot of different ideas, because not everyone there was Adventist. There are people there who their parents pay for them to go and they just went because of that, or people from other faiths and stuff like that. So it wasn't just like, here's the thing you're supposed to believe it, and everything's okay.
Right.
Now I'm being presented with, like, for example, Ellen White is, I guess you would kind of say like the Joseph Smith of Adventism.
Okay.
She's, known as like a prophetess, or like she'll even be referred to as the spirit of prophecy.
Okay.
But I don't know if it was because she was a woman or because people in the denomination were putting her above God or above the Bible. She was always trying to like downplay her role and the significance of writings and stuff. I took a class called Adventist Heritage.
Okay.
And the teacher was writing a book, and it was a book defending her. And, from the criticisms that she's had about plagiarism and just whether or not her prophecies came true, all those kinds of things. And one of the things he did was like, he showed us like the websites where they would criticize her. He wasn't like hiding any of the stuff from us. So we would all look at it, and it was some pretty wild shit. Like,
yeah.
That I had never thought of, or I had never experienced before. And then I was like, well, I can't believe any of this stuff, because then I'm going to lose my faith. Or, that's just the devil trying to make me lose my salvation. So there was a lot of moments like that in college where I'd be presented with something and I would think about it, but I was like, well, I can't think about it.
Right. You're kind of not allowing yourself to really explore those questions.
Right. Yeah. So it was just a constant tug of war with that. And, things were beginning to get more and more difficult in life, and just with me and family and just trying to survive. And, I'm also searching for, what does God want me to do? What is his will for my life? Because my will is bad. And if I make a decision by myself, that's a bad thing. I'm supposed, God takes precedent over everything. So I was like waiting for that something, that thing, something, a sign, anything. Yeah. And I didn't know what that was supposed to look like, but I was fasting and praying and trying to get something. You know, it seems very simple when you read the Bible. It's like, ask and you shall receive. And I feel like I asked like every kind of way that you can ask, yeah, and still didn't get anything. So yeah, it just became harder and harder to believe, because everything is based around this system where it's like, God is in control of everything, but yeah, God never contacts you. God never talks to you. You have other people telling you what God is supposed to be saying to you and what you're supposed to be doing and what your role is as a human being. And, you know, whenever I talk to other people about what God meant to them, it would be, you know, like, oh, well, you know, God gives me these impressions. Mm-hmm. You know, there would never be anything concrete. And for the people who did have like these amazing stories about how, you know, they saw angels, or, you know, their daughter was sick and had cancer or whatever, and there was nothing the doctors could do. And then they prayed, and up to that point, you know, nothing, things were looking bad, but then everything turned around. Right. You know, I can't take any of those stories and make them, that, you know, those stories aren't going to do anything in my life. They're just going to be stories, someone else's story, you know? Mm.
Yeah, I think that's a really common theme as well, that the people who take very seriously their faith, and particularly their, the stories of their faith, the traditions, the Bible, the Quran, what have you.
Yeah.
And you take it seriously. Like, shouldn't God be intervening? Shouldn't God be working in some way, doing something? And when you're just honest with yourself and you're recognizing that that's not happening, this is the kind of doubts that take place.
Yeah. And I never got anything. And that was frustrating. Like, I used to go on walks in the woods. I always had like a very conversational kind of prayer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd either like write in a prayer book, and it would just be like writing my thoughts or whatever. It wasn't, it's kind of like high and lofty stuff that you would hear at church. Like, I would just talk to God like he was my friend. I mean, that's, yeah. You know, I remember that being told to me. So that's what I tried to do. And, you know, towards the end, I would like go on like nature trails, and I'd bring my Bible, and I would open it up and try to get something, because I felt like I wasn't getting anything. And it just really frustrated me. And I ended up praying my last prayer in 2010.
Okay.
And it was my sentiment was basically, I've really tried to reach you and to hear from you. I'm not hearing anything. And if you want to do something, you go ahead and do that. But I'm not going to continue to spin my wheels here for nothing.
Yeah.
And it was probably another couple of years. Like, I sort of waited to see if I would hear something, or if, right, I would, you know, because I figure, like, if God wants to communicate with me, he can do that, and I'll know it's him, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I still didn't get anything. So, man, that time frame seems so far away now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy.
But it wasn't that long ago. I mean, that specific moment was 10 years ago, but...
Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I know you have met Ryan Bell, or you listen to his podcast.
Yeah, I have met him.
Yeah, after I had deconverted, one of the things that just really hit me hard was when he did an episode of Life After God where he talked about the song, Say Something, I'm Giving Up On You, being this really powerful thing for him. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but it's a very evocative song, and the lead singer is saying, you know, it's about a relationship, right?
Yeah.
You have to respond to me somehow, or I have to walk away from this.
Yeah.
And it ties so directly into the experience of praying to a non-existent God, right? Like, you're just saying, do something, respond back to me in some way. It can't be a one-sided relationship.
Yeah. I was actually thinking about Ryan Bell. I actually got introduced to him through my mother, because after I came out to her as an atheist, she really didn't understand it. And it was at that same time Ryan Bell was doing his Year Without God.
Okay.
And he was getting like coverage on CNN and stuff. So she had seen a clip and she showed it to me and she was like, see, this is what happens when you let the devil take control, you
right.
know, you start doing things like this. And it was through that that I was like, oh, okay, well, I actually might be interested in following the blog. So I started doing that and then I joined the group and it just kind of snowballed for me, connections in secular community and, you know, podcasts and everything else. But it kind of started with that.
Yeah, that's funny. So your mom basically turned you on to Ryan's work.
Yeah.
Yeah, inadvertently.
Yeah. And I met him a couple of years ago and I told him that. He thought it was really funny.
That's an awesome story. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So let's step back for just a second. You mentioned telling your mom. How did that go? What was that experience like?
It was terrible.
Okay.
It did not go well at all. It was kind of a moment of her, I guess she was kind of noticing that I was changing or just disenchanted with the church and God. And she was like, I don't ever hear you talk about Jesus or talk about God. And, you know, I was working weekends. I took a weekend shift so that I could go to school full time and still bring in the same amount of money. And after I finished the school program, she was like, okay, you know, when are you going to start going to church again?
Right,
I was just
right.
like, oh, they don't have any shifts open right now, but I wasn't looking.
Yeah.
So, you know, she just kept kind of prodding at me. And then one day I was just like, well, you know, here, you want to know? Here it is. And I told her. And I didn't really plan anything. I didn't think about how she would react to it or how it was going to affect her or our relationship or anything like that. I don't know. I guess in my mind at that time, I thought we would just have a conversation about it, but it just turned into much more than that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. You know, it's been a long, that was like 2014 when I did that.
Okay.
And we would just have so many arguments, so many run-ins. There were times where I would be at work and I didn't have a car back then. And she'd be like, hey, your grandma's in town. You want me to pick you up after work or whatever? And I'm thinking we're just going to hang out. But then we end up going to an evangelistic series, you know.
Right.
And I'm just like, you know, you lied. You know, you lied, Mom. She's like, no, I didn't lie. I was like, yeah, if you had told me that, I wouldn't have come. But I think for a long time she felt like, well, for some reason, he just doesn't remember anything that, like the whole first 25 or 24, however many years in my life at that point, you know, like it's just been wiped.
Yeah.
You know, like the whole like Men in Black, you know, flash the thing
yes.
through your eyes and
yeah.
you just forget everything. So maybe she felt like if I heard it again or if I was exposed to it again, then suddenly it would all just come back and I'd be saved again. But
right.
Yeah, I think even now she still doesn't understand. I've tried to talk about it and it just never goes well.
I'm really sorry to hear that. That's some of the hardest things, I think, when you experience this faith transition is trying to connect with family who are still believers. You know, try to show them that you love them, but if they won't see you as a full human being, that's hard to grapple with sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I also, this was more recent. I came out to her as gay, which most of my friends already knew that about me. Okay. And I was pretty much only worried about her. You know, that was kind of like the big,
right,
the big thing. And it didn't go as bad.
Interesting.
I mean, okay. Well, it wasn't like an angry kind of reaction. That's what I got when I came out as an atheist. But she was very sad and she was very disappointed. And, you know, I wrote her a letter this time, you know, trying to be a little more thought out.
Get the whole thing out at one time. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think she's had a really hard time accepting me. Like, to her, this is just like the next step in my apostasy, you know, like, right. If you're an atheist, you're probably gonna be a sexual deviant.
Oh man.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and yeah, we're basically at a point where, as of right now, I haven't spoken to her in a couple of months. It's just been hard. I mean, and I think because, like, I've been dating now, and I've been, like, before, it was just kind of like, oh, you have no idea what you're talking about or what these things that you're saying you are. Mm. There's, you know, this isn't you, you know, but right. It's just crazy. Like, I've tried a lot and I don't really know what else to do at this point.
Oh man, that's heartbreaking. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So when we started to connect on Facebook, it was clear to me that music has been a major part of your life. So you mentioned being a part of a choir, and you now have a blog that you talk about music a fair amount. Tell me a little bit about what music meant to you as a believer and how you see it now, or how important it is to you today.
Yeah, music has always been super important to me. Part of the reason for that is, while I was like really sheltered, I was able to have like my own stereo.
Right, right, right.
When I was a kid, when I was like 8 or 9. And of course, everything that was in the house was gospel records.
Yeah.
You know, gospel and Christian records. But I still, even within that framework, I was able to pretty much listen to whatever I wanted. So I would listen to like all different kinds of styles. And it was just always an experience for me. And then also on top of that, I was into Christian music heavy just because that's what was in the house. And I would read the liner notes and read the producer credits and like look at the covers. And, you know, I was just very into that. And when my life started to begin to shift a bit more, Christian music just wasn't really cutting it for me. Like, it wasn't, it was only expressing like praise, mm-hmm. or like I'm unworthy, and you know, what am I supposed to do with this feeling of unworthiness? Oh, I give it up to God and then everything's okay. And to me, that just wasn't real life. So that's when I started to kind of venture out and listen to secular music and discover that there's all these different styles and there's all these different genres, and Christian music kind of as an industry really is just like the Jesus version of whatever the style
right.
is, yes. You know?
Yeah.
So, and that kind of changed a lot for me. I still have a soft spot for gospel music just because I think there's something unique about specifically like Black gospel music that yeah. is different. Like, it's kind of like its own sound. And then like from that came Motown and blues and like all these, you know, rock and roll and all these other things.
We don't have R&B without Aretha Franklin, you know, doing gospel music, right? Like, you know, that is so integral to music, the gospel influence on rock and roll.
Well, like they all did, almost like, you know, Ray Charles, like all of these artists, they sang it. Whitney Houston, you know, all of them, they all grew up singing in the church, and they took the skills and the sound that they learned from singing in the church and incorporated into secular music. Yeah, I mean, I became a music nerd just because I was sheltered for so long, and music is what has gotten me through being suicidal, going through dealing with religious doubt, being a gay man in an environment in the culture that's not accepting.
Right.
And, you know, music has always like kind of been that pathway for me to like feel like, okay, like I can get through this, or I'm comfortable, you know, I can gain confidence just by listening to music, you know, versus just winging it on my own.
Well, and I think that it's just a deeply human thing to be moved by music. You know, part of what is happening in church when people sing together is you're having this community experience of the music and participating by singing, and, you know, something very human, very natural is taking place there.
Yeah.
So of course music has just a profound impact on us.
Yeah. There was always like this kind of line, and I never knew where the line was that, you know, even within Christian music, it's like, oh, that sounds too much like the world. Shouldn't listen to this artist or this song, or, you know, like, oh, they sampled a secular song and a gospel song, so that's bad. Or, you know, they're dancing. They're calling it praise dancing, but it's still bad, you know? Or, you know, I mean, there's just a host of scenarios where like, oh, okay, well, this isn't good. And like, for me, I was just like, well, whatever.
Yeah.
And I guess coming out of that, I just kind of had that approach when I began to listen to music. It's been a while. I still want to create music again, but I used to, you know, produce a lot of electronic and hip hop stuff. And at one point I was going to create this Christian rap album that I thought, like, I was like, this is going to be like an actual good album, not like an album where it's like you put on a beat and like the rapper is like reciting Bible verses that rhyme or something, I wanted it to be like a really cool and sonically interesting album and like tell a real story. And like, I wrote and recorded a bunch of those songs, and then I deconverted and I was still trying to make it. I was like, man, I just don't, like, I can't say these things anymore. You know?
Right, right. That famous saying that Christians don't tell lies, they sing them. You know, right? Like,
nice.
When I have gone to church, you know, after my deconversion, it's like, it's really painful to actually listen to some of the words of Christian worship songs because they're just demonstrably untrue. And it's hard to take.
Again, it's all about that line, right? Like, how much can you express yourself and still be considered a Christian before it becomes carnal or evil? Or,
right.
You know, how much fun can you have? No, you're having too much fun. You know, you're supposed to sing like very plain, straight line hymns, or, you know, straight singing with no embellishments and no charisma or anything. There is always kind of that line. And the more that you appreciate art, the more you realize it's, you know, like the highest form of like what it is to be human. Like, we're creating things that are about our emotions and our thoughts and our feelings and being honest about them. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to refer to the specific blog post that you and I chatted about. It's the one for Her, H-E-R.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The song is called Lord Is Coming. And the first time I heard that, I just was like, I stopped in my tracks. It was like, this is incredible. I love this song.
Yeah.
And you comment, though, I'm going to quote you here. I just thought this was really, really interesting. Yeah. It feels like a spiritual, waiting on God to deliver you and your people from oppression and depression, and sincerely crying out in anguish for such a thing to happen. It just, man, Stephen, that's beautiful, man. You have captured what I find deeply compelling about gospel music is there's this yearning, this calling out, this like, we need help, right? And like, yeah, there's something very deep about that.
Yeah, I mean, when I heard that song, I think I saw it performed at like an award show, mm-hmm, and her, you know, it's weird to refer to.
Yes, yeah, it's hard to talk about her.
But yeah, she primarily sings, and she was kind of doing a lot of spoken word in this song, and that kind of like, I was like, oh, this is really different, almost kind of like Lauryn Hill-ish.
Yeah.
But when I listened to the things that she was saying, it was just like, yep, she's right. And then at the end, it's just like, the Lord is coming for his people. I'm just like, oh no.
Yes.
So I actually, what kind of brings it around for me is the other artist, YBN Cordae, because, mm-hmm, I feel like his verse kind of sounds like more of what I feel, you know, like kind, mm-hmm, of in the midst with all this backdrop of like, the Lord is coming, our help's not coming from man. He's kind of like, hey, let me say how I feel. Like, this is like the shit I'm going through. And I don't know if God's coming or not. This is just the reality we're, yes, dealing with. Kind of having those two perspectives put together on a song with a gospel choir, it just captured the whole experience of like what it means to be Black and to be a believer. It's so embedded in the culture. And I know a lot of people who aren't Black, you know, say that, well, like, I've always heard that. And yeah, it's a true thing, but it just runs so much deeper than you can imagine. Like, it's not just like being in a Southern white town and people asking you what church you go to. Like, it's just, you're expected to like, okay, let's pray. You know, like, I've had even moments like that at work where it's like, oh, we're just, we all know we all believe in Jesus up in here. So I'm not going to ask whether or not it's polite to do this. We're just going to do it. It's just so embedded in the culture from every angle, every facet. And you know, it's because of oppression. So that almost makes it, like, I had to write a more in-depth blog about that song because it's coming from Black artists and they're talking about oppression.
Right.
But the solution in that is presented in the song is God. And I feel like it's not really a solution. But at the same time, that sentiment is like a very real sentiment in African American culture. So like, I get it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It frustrates me, but I still like the song.
So I wanted to briefly talk about the Black experience as well. Obviously, that is not my experience.
Yeah.
I've heard Anthony Pinn talk about this as well. He's a, mm-hmm, Black humanist writer, that the church is more than just a spiritual congregation for the Black community, but it is also the place where it's a needed, it's a required community to support one another against the oppression or racism, mm-hmm, that would bear down on that community without it.
Yeah.
Is that your experience?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about it. It's such like a mind... it's a mind fuck, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't understand. And a lot of times when I talk to other Black people, and it's not like I'm trying to demonize anyone for having whatever beliefs that they have.
Sure.
But the process just isn't really thought out. It's just like, oh, okay, well, I don't know if God exists, but just in case he does, you know,
yeah.
I'm still going to believe. Or the probably like more seasoned person would probably say, well, you know, God's brought us through all these different times, you know, like civil rights and slavery and, you know, to even go back to the music aspect of it, you know, like Negro spirituals, blues, like all of that stuff was born out of these situations. And of course, like the musical styles have been taken further and like become like commercial and everything like that. But the original roots of a lot of these songs, you know, come from having to struggle and having no hope. So you're creating something in order to keep you going. And when you don't have any hope and you don't have any friends in high places, there's something to be said for just trying to have like a ridiculous hope or faith in something, just to have something to grasp onto.
Yeah.
Like, especially in a time period like that, like I can't even imagine what it would be like to like your whole entire world is controlled. And if you step out of line, you're probably going to die or who knows, be tortured or whatever. Like it's so crazy. So crazy.
I've always thought about it. For me, why it speaks to me is the trite saying that suffering creates great art. And there's no oppressed group of people who have suffered more than the Black community. And so that comes out in soul, that comes out in gospel, that comes out in the blues. So I know that's the white boy perspective. Sorry.
No, I think you got it. I mean, there's just, you're not going to be able to get that authentic kind of raw expression. I mean, I think that goes for like any genre, like like a purist punk rock person who came about in listening to that at that time, they're going to feel a certain way about like what that music represents. Versus like someone who listens to like Blink 182 or Green Day or something like that, you know, which is fine. You know, those are fine bands, but there's just something to be said for like the purest expression of what it means to be human. And that means you're sad, you're depressed, you're lonely, you're happy, you're joyful, you know, you're filled with emotion, you know, you're feeling something versus, you know, like, I want to make a song that people are going to like and it's going to be a hit. So I think particularly when you listen to like culture music, that's not just like whatever the mainstream white majority is, which is typically like just a more slicker, cleaner version of whatever Black people are doing.
No, seriously, man.
That's usually what it is.
It's a terrible history of just taking great art from the Black community and repackaging it. It's terrible.
Yeah. But I mean, I like it all, man. I don't like to be boxed in. Like there's a lot of Black people my age that just listen to like whatever their parents listen to. And like, I don't know, like Chris Brown radio or something like that. You know, it's just like, you know, it's like there's more to music than just that.
Yeah, I was going to comment just real clear for the listeners. Steven's blog is fascinating and your musical catalog is eclectic and crosses many different boundaries. And so unlike me, you have a much greater breadth of knowledge of music. And
well, you know, I'm just a fan at the end of the day.
So I did want to just turn a small corner here and say that, so we've talked about why some of gospel music is so powerful. And it's that hopefulness in the face of daunting suffering.
Yeah.
And so the humanist message we can pull out of that is that human beings are capable of withstanding really horrifying things. And with hope, they can move forward.
Oh, absolutely. Have you read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl?
I have not yet. No, I have to get that on the list. Yeah.
Well, it was a book that was recommended to me, and it's a pretty short read. Even if you do it on an audiobook, it's like maybe like 4.5 hours or something like that.
Okay.
But the author was Jewish, And he was in concentration camps and all of that. And he's a psychologist as well. So he was talking about his experience and also the experiences of others and how they survived and how the ones who didn't survive, you know, mm-hmm. and what was the difference between their behavior, what they would think about, what they would talk about. And just even just simple things like, you know, when they would first get to the camp, little or what would seem like little things to them after a period of time, you know, like the first time you see someone get beat or they're denied food for a stupid reason. And, you know, there's barely enough food to go around or, you know, like nine guys have to sleep in a bunk. And maybe if they can sneak a shoe in for a pillow, that sounds terrible. But he's like, 2 weeks later, you know, we can see someone get beat and it won't faze us at all. Or, you know, that shoe will feel like a down pillow, you know?
Right.
So I think we're, as humans, we're really capable of just adapting to whatever our situation is. We're going to find a way to grow a flower in concrete, you know?
Absolutely, man. Yeah. The other thing that you had mentioned, and I think is a hopeful note, is that you have experienced community in the secular community now, and that has kind of really helped ease this transition for you. So what are some of the experiences you've had with the secular community?
The secular community has been so great for me. I've met a group of individuals in the Nashville area and in different areas too. I lived in Cincinnati and I came in contact with Bart Campolo. And so I was a part of his group for a while when I was up there. Yeah, it's just everyone's been really embracing and I really appreciate that. You know, I needed that in order to be able to be myself.
Right.
Because I was not comfortable with myself for a long time. I hated myself. I was suicidal. I didn't know what to do with me. And now I feel so much more comfortable just being who I authentically am and, you know, kind of just letting the chips fall where they may. And that wouldn't have happened without me being able to have friends that just accept me for who I am. And then I can laugh with them. I can cry with them. I can be awkward or insecure.
Yeah.
And I never felt like I had that in church. Felt like I always had to be a certain person or I had to represent Christ. And I had like that burden of just measuring up. And I don't have to worry about that in secular community. Yeah, it's been great. Now, like, it hasn't met all my needs.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I mean, most of the time, I'm the only Black person in pretty much every secular group I go to. But it certainly has been helpful as far as finding acceptance and giving me like a place to kind of reset and figure myself out without judgment.
That's amazing. You may have heard me say before this idea of secular grace. You've just described it beautifully. To be able to be yourself, to be awkward or sad or happy or whatever you're feeling in the moment, and to be accepted for who you are, that's secular grace. That's the kind of thing that I think that we as the secular community can put forward that is better than what the church can do, right? We can truly embrace one another and see the humanity in each other. We can recognize our differences, our different experiences, because we see the humanity in each other. We can accept one another and love one another in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think we get caught up in the idea of being a good person or a bad person. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's no such thing as either one. Like we're all human and we're all capable of the same things. And when we realize that, we can decide how we want to live our lives and how we want to treat people and stop demonizing each other and ourselves for bad decisions that we've made or times when we've hurt people. And I know it's a crazy kind of idea, but just like try to imagine the person or people that you think are like the worst people in the world, or like they're terrible, they're trash, you know, and like they're monsters, and they're human beings too, you know. At the same time, there's probably someone in your life that you've been a monster to, you know, and when they think of you, they think of this terrible person, you know, who's hurt me or hurt my family or did me wrong or whatever the case may be. Like, we all play these different roles in other people's lives. And when we see the things we don't like in ourselves and other people, that's when we go into attack mode, or like, they're the worst, you know?
Yeah, yes, yep.
So it's very easy to just like take out our anger and frustration on those people, especially when we don't know them too.
So Stephen, if somebody's listening to the podcast today, hearing your story, and they have had similar experiences to you and they're beginning their doubts, what would you want to say to them?
That's always an interesting question for me. I don't know. I would say just be honest with yourself. Mm. Honesty is not a contest to see who's more right. You know, honesty is just about being authentic and about being real and engaging your brain to like accept the reality of whatever the situation is. And if you find yourself at a place where your faith or your community or your family or relationships, that you can't authentically be yourself or you can't authentically engage with that world anymore, then maybe you should reevaluate.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of been my story. I mean, I haven't read a bunch of atheist books, or I didn't kind of intellectualize my way out of it. It was just more of a, I knew that I could not be myself in this environment. I knew that I couldn't continue to be the fake version of me and sustain that. And knowing those two things, I had to get out. Mm. It wasn't easy, and I know it's not easy for a lot of people to just do that. There's a lot of risk that comes with that decision, especially depending on how steeped you are in a religious community. I think everyone should just do what they can, and you'll know what that is when you're honest with yourself. That's the only way you're going to know. Now, no one can tell you what's right for you but you. Which, again, that's a hard thing to hear if you're still religious. But that's the truth, man. Like, there's no other voice out there that's going to jump into you and give you all the answers and explain the meaning of life. You have to go out there and find it and make your own meaning.
Very well said. Stephen, for people who are just dying to read your blog, because we've talked about how awesome it is, how can they find that, and how can they get in touch with you if they wanted to talk to you?
Thanks for that, by the way. I really appreciate it. Because, you know, I just do the blog for fun. I've been doing it for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years now. I literally just do it for fun.
Sure.
That's it. So I don't know. Maybe it might turn into something else, or maybe you'll see me writing for a publication at some point.
I was going to say, man, like the in-depth analysis and of the music itself, and then you're also adding a personal touch to it. It's beautifully written. If anybody who is a publisher out there, you need to hire Steven because he's an amazing. This guy is available, man. You need to go get him.
I'm definitely available, that's for sure. But yeah, the website is barryorchestra.tumblr.com. You know, that's it. Also, if you feel brave enough to want to hear like the stuff that I've actually created and produced or played around with, you can go to barryorchestra.bandcamp.com. So I've got some stuff up there.
Excellent.
Some instrumental stuff.
Steven, thank you so much for telling your story with such honesty and vulnerability. I really thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Final thoughts on the episode. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Steven Barry as much as I did. I think Steven has a vulnerability and a truthfulness in the way that he tells his story that is just amazing. I really identify with a lot of the process that he went through, the experience of having prayer not work the way that you want it to, and then feeling guilty about that not happening. Steven says, I really have tried to reach you. He's calling out to God, and yet he doesn't hear anything from God. And that can be a really lonely place to be. To quote him here, he says, and I would think about something and then think, I can't think about that. When he originally gets to college and is exposed to other ideas and having, even within his own faith tradition, challenge those ideas, faith should be able to stand up to scrutiny. And if it doesn't, the problem is not with scrutiny, the problem is with the faith. Another quote from Stephen, no voice is going to tell you the meaning of life. You need to go out there and make your own meaning. Stephen knew that he couldn't be himself, that he was a gay man, and that that wouldn't be accepted, and that also pushed him out. I'm very encouraged about Stephen discovering community in Nashville and the secular community there, and that that is a replacement for the Black community for him. Although, as he points out, he often is the only Black man there, so we need to do more about creating community for people of color in the secular community and embrace everyone who's going through these deconversions and deconstructions. The secular grace thought of the week is this, to be accepted for your authentic self, to quote Stephen, is secular grace. And it is actually from human being to human being that we accept one another and see the authentic self in each other. As always, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be a graceful human being. Time for some footnotes. The song is a track called Waves by Micaiah Beats. Please check out her music. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to help support the podcast, here are the ways you can go about that. First, help promote it. A podcast audience grows by word of mouth. If you found it useful or just entertaining, please pass it on to your friends and family. Post about it on social media so that others can find it. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This will help raise the visibility of our show. Join me on the podcast. Tell your story. Have you gone through a faith transition? You want to tell that to the world? Let me know and let's have you on. Do you know someone who needs to tell their story? Let them know. Do you have criticisms about atheism or humanism, but you're willing to have an honesty contest with me? Come on the show. If you have a book or a blog that you want to promote, I'd like to hear from you. Also, you can contribute technical support. If you are good at graphic design, sound engineering, or marketing, please let me know and I'll let you know how you can participate. And finally, financial support. There will be a link on the show notes to allow contributions which would help defray the cost of producing the show. If you want to get in touch with me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, or you can send email to gracefulatheist@gmail.com. You can tweet at me at gracefulatheist, or you can just check out my website at gracefulatheist.wordpress.com. get in touch and let me know if you appreciate the podcast. Well, this has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. Grab somebody you love and tell them how much they mean to you. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.